This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt. And on this evening's program, David Elliott will join us by phone from Washington, D.C. for his monthly look at how Washington politics affects the GLBT community. Tonight, David will be looking specifically at the president's health care initiative and how it might affect our community. Then on News Wrap from This Way Out, the man accused of killing gay Navy seaman August Provost commits suicide. Salt Lake City's prosecutor refuses to press trespassing charges against a gay kissing couple, while the great nationwide kiss-in to affirm same-gender affection is scheduled for August 15th. And by the way, tonight we'll have a local angle on the kiss-in, and I'll mention more about that in a moment. Tim Brookover will be here to discuss the third 2009 quarterly meeting of the Community Leaders Networking Group coming up Saturday at the Houston GLBT Community Center on Montrose Boulevard. It's an opportunity for community leaders, activists, and advocates to meet in an informal setting and discuss community issues and ideas and to share information on their respective organizations in an informal atmosphere. The meeting is open to everyone and no RSVP is required. Then at 10 o'clock, the beginning of our second hour, Joan Devlin joins us by telephone from Iowa to interview Frederick Hertz, the author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnership, and Civil Unions. As Joan put it, the book's title, Making It Legal, is a pun. It refers to the political struggle to obtain marriage equality, but also to the personal decision, should a couple continue to cohabitate, or should they make it legal by marrying in places where they can? And what about the Obama's administration's changes that he's about to make to the GLBT marriage landscape? They'll look at all of that. And then finally this evening, later on in the second hour, James Oxford of Impact Houston will join us to discuss what they're calling the Sizzling Summer Soiree fundraiser. That's happening this coming Sunday, August 9th. And the Kiss-In event, there it is, the Kiss-In event that follows that a week from this Saturday. The Kiss-In is planned to start at 1 p.m. and to be held at Discovery Green downtown. And, of course, we have our feature segments as well from This Way Out.
And, yes, so we've got a packed show.
Yeah.
So why don't we jump right into it with David Elliott. Good evening, David.
David, you there?
I am here.
Well, this is Jack and Jennifer in the studio with you.
Well, hello, Jack, and hello, Jennifer, and hello, Queer Voices.
Welcome to the show. What's going on in Washington?
Well, Jack and Jennifer, I have to tell you, the heat is on. In normal years, when August comes to Washington, D.C., everybody goes home. Nothing's going on. Instead, it's totally different this year. Instead, this year, over the next 30 days, we have one of the most important battles in the history of progressive politics in the United States. Now, I've got a trivia question I'd like to ask the two of you, if I may.
Okay.
Okay.
What do Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid have in common?
It's a government-run program.
What else?
Okay.
Taxpayer-funded.
Okay, let me take a stab at this.
Okay.
These three programs defined the social contract between government and her people,
okay,
and how that relationship exists in the United States. If you are old, We will take care of you. If you are poor, we will take care of you. If you are infirmed, old or poor, we will take care of you. And that brings me to the fight of all fights.
Well, you know, David, it's really interesting. In today's Chronicle, they sort of described what it would be like to have the same program that the Congress and senators have.
Yeah, the program where members of Congress basically get four times as good health care benefits as the rest of us.
Right, and they have a choice of like 12 different programs, where most of us are lucky if we have a choice of one.
Right. So here's the deal. For months and months, many organizations nationally and in Houston have been organizing, campaigning, lobbying relentlessly for quality, affordable health care for all. And two things have happened now. On the one hand, we are almost there. We've gotten bills through four important committees, three in the House, one in the Senate. There's still another committee that's kind of hanging out there. At the same time, though, conservatives are organizing like you would not believe to kill the promise of quality, affordable health care for all. Now, four good things have happened. You know, I'm somebody who's been in this fight for months and months now. And we knew going in that four things had to happen. First of all, progressive groups had to come together and overcome our modest, and they are modest, policy differences. And we had to overcome our internal, external personality power struggles in order to pull together for a strong progressive plan. That's happened. Second, President Obama would have to lay out an aggressive timeline for health care reform and keep nudging it along on Capitol Hill. He'd also have to put out some big and progressive policy goals and then fight for them. That's happened. Yeah, we sort of missed the August deadline, but we're moving along. Third, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would have to work the conservative Democrats in the House, the so-called blue dogs, hard enough to get their votes without selling out progressives on the left by giving too much away. So far, that's happened. Fourth, the progressive wing of the House would have to hang tough and push back hard on attempts to weaken proposed health care reform legislation. So, we're on our way. After all the pushing and shoving, after all the threats and counter threats we've seen over the past month, the deals and counter deals, after all the negotiating back and forth, so far, so good. There is no reason for us to be overly optimistic because we still have a long way to go. We still have mountains to climb before we get there. But reform is alive because all of these four things are happening. And, you know, we still may get outgunned and beaten by the insurance lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, by the Republicans. These are powerful and intense and organized moneyed interests that are working against us. But House Speaker Pelosi and President Obama, so far, they're sticking to it. They may not at the end. We have to keep pushing them. We can't let progressives in the House to get picked off one by one to vote for a bad deal. We can't let our progressive organizations to run out of energy. We have to keep the heat on during this August. We can't divide among ourselves. We have
David, it definitely seems like it's an uphill battle. I mean, they keep chipping away. I mean, first of all, it's not a single-payer system, which a lot of us think should be the way they should go. And there's a concern about whether there's going to even be a government option as they keep chipping away. And it's just amazing how they're not really offering any other alternative. And even, you know, for the people who do have insurance by their company, a lot of people still keep losing that because companies cannot afford the insurance.
Jack, you know, 12,000 Americans are losing their health insurance every day in this country.
That's just incredible.
It is incredible. And yet, the job in front of us, and I'm so frustrated in trying to articulate this, the job in front of us is complex. After all, we're talking about reforming one-sixth of the American economy. That's what we're talking about.
Right, and it also should be noted that we in this country pay more for health care than any other industrialized country and get less.
Yeah, we rank something like 27th in terms of what we get. And now we are out there, and basically, you know, the bill that's going to come out of the House, the bill that's going to come out of the Senate, each bill is going to be about 1,000 pages long. And the other side, the Republicans, you wouldn't believe what they are doing to try to defeat this thing. For example, the biggest thing is they are charging that we are calling for euthanasia.
Oh, yes, kill granny.
Yeah, Jennifer, you
saw that? I saw that commercial, how we're going to kill granny.
You see that, and they're charging that this is about abortion. Well, you know what? Our bill does call for reproductive health care. But reproductive health care means a whole lot of things. It means a pap screening. It means, you know, you get various screens for cancer. It means that you have access to birth control. It's just incredible what lies the other side is putting out. But what we have to keep talking about is the magical words: quality, affordable health care for all. And that's what we're about.
Well, the wonder I have is that this, Jennifer, the Congress has health plans. What's so complicated about allowing the rest of us who, like myself, don't have insurance to opt into one of those systems? I mean, don't we deserve at least as good?
Well, and I read somewhere else that somebody was suggesting, well, maybe the Congress and Senate ought to be able to, try to get health care in the open market like some of us else have to do, and see how easy it is. Because I never hear anybody talk about pre-existing conditions. That doesn't even seem to be in there. Just like the movie that Michael Moore did about Sicko. That was all about people who actually did have insurance and were not able to access it. Some people who do have private health insurance, as soon as something happens, they're dropped from it.
Well, Jack, 48 million Americans don't have access to health insurance right now. And if we pass this thing, they will. And what a lot of folks don't understand is those of us, and I'm one of those who's fortunate to have a good health insurance plan. Those of us who have health insurance plans, we're paying basically $1,000 a year for uninsured folks to go to emergency rooms. Well, guess what? Those uninsured folks, in many cases, wouldn't have to go to emergency rooms if they had quality, affordable health care.
Right. And if there was a system in this country to encourage people, if they had insurance, to see their doctor on a regular basis, so that they didn't have to go to an emergency room every time there's a problem.
Yeah, well care is underrated how important it is.
And the other thing that they always keep talking about is how bad this system works in Canada or in the United Kingdom or in France. And I know, you know, there are some problems in every system that comes along, but it's better.
Oh, yeah, and Jennifer just mentioned a key phrase, well care. Yeah, hello. Shouldn't we be promoting healthcare policies that invest in prevention?
Yes.
You know, look at the number of people who are obese. Look at the number of people who aren't getting tests that they need for cancer because it costs an outrageous amount of money, and yet the tests, you know, only cost like $10 or $15 in real terms, but you know, if they don't have insurance, it's several hundred dollars.
Right, and the people who don't have insurance get charged more by hospitals and doctors than people who do have insurance.
Right.
Oh well, you're in a hospital, an aspirin, which you know costs a couple of pennies on the market at the pharmacy, may cost you $7 or $8 in the hospital.
So, David, you're working on these issues, and that's part of what you do professionally. You really feel that there's a good chance that this will happen, even though what the other side is doing and how they're trying to organize without even using facts.
Well, Jack, I have a personal anecdote to share with you. I have a friend of mine who is chief of staff to a moderate member of Congress who happens to be a doctor. And my friend went to, you know, his boss, the congressman, and said, Congressman, you ought to go back home and you ought to start up your business, your medical business. You know, he's a general practitioner, doctor. And the member of Congress looked at my friend and said, why? And my friend said, because, sir, if health care doesn't pass this year, you're not coming back.
Wow.
Oh.
And it's the truth. If the Democrats lose 40 seats in Congress next year, they will lose control of the House of Representatives.
You really
if they
think
do
so?
Not,
wow.
If they do not pass health care reform, they will come close to losing 40 seats.
Astounding.
It's the truth. It's the truth. The Americans are going to look at Democrats and they're going to say, look, you control the White House, you have healthy majorities in the House and Senate. We demanded health care reform. That was the number one issue going into the November election last year, folks, and you didn't get it done.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Both senators from Texas have announced that they're going to vote against the Supreme Court nominee. So I would imagine that both of them are going to vote against any type of health care reform. And even the senator, Ms. Hutchinson, who's considered a little bit more moderate, since she wants to run for governor and she has to prove her conservative credentials, I'm sure she's going to vote against it.
She definitely is. But, Jack, can I use that to kind of play jujitsu
sure.
here and go
sure.
to another topic?
Yes.
My gosh. The U.S. Senate race in Texas, we're looking at a special election in May, and people in Texas are getting something that the insiders in Washington, D.C. aren't getting yet, and that's that the Democrats could win.
Mm-hmm. How so? Tell me more.
Houston, the mayor of Houston... Everybody is saying, down in Texas, from all of the blogs I'm reading, he he could emerge as a relatively, you know, I know John Sharp's in there, but relatively unified Democrat. You're dealing with strange election laws. If you have an election in May, the top two vote getters.
Right, it's an open. There is no Republican or Democratic primary. It's an open seat, so it's a free for all.
Right. So the Houston Mayor Bill White, right?
Right. Yes, that's him.
He is well funded. He is building a field operation. The Republicans are in a bit of a pickle in terms of who they're backing. Next May, Texas could shock the nation by sending a Democrat to the U.S. Senate.
Well,
and nobody inside the Beltway is getting that.
Right, but do you think that maybe Kay Bailey Hutchinson might just back down, knowing that she has an uphill battle now to run for governor?
You know, I've been looking at the polling really, really closely between Kay Bailey Hutchinson and Rick Perry, and I've been studying the election dynamic, and it is a really difficult. I don't know that I've ever seen a more difficult race to handicap.
Right.
I mean, it's true that Rick Perry has, you know, the sort of the radical right wing tea bag people behind him. But there are a lot of really moderate Republican women in the suburbs all around Texas who, you know, they're not driven by ideology. They're driven by getting their kid to the bus stop on time Monday morning, Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning, Thursday morning, Friday morning, and then picking them up after school and getting them to the soccer game and what have you. And Kay Bailey Hutchinson's moderation might appeal to them a little bit.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting.
The Hutchinson, look, I'm going to make one prediction between the Kay Bailey Hutchinson Rick Perry battle, assuming it goes forward, assuming that one candidate doesn't withdraw. The one prediction I'm going to make is that it will come down to within one percentage point.
Well, you know, since these primaries are sort of open, well, there won't be, that's right, there won't even be a primary. It's going to be an open race. So there may be, no, I'm sorry, I'm backing up here. I'm getting those two races mixed up.
Yeah, well, that's easy to do, Jack. I've done the same thing.
Well, you deal with 50 states. I'm only dealing with one state. But for the Republican primary for governor, there may be a number of Democrats who cross over and vote in the Republican race and may support Kay Bailey Hutchinson.
Oh, sure. Oh, if Democrats wanted to do it, I mean, like, if your show, you know, I don't think your show could do this because of election laws, but if various progressive groups wanted to do it, progressives in Texas could deliver the gubernatorial Republican nomination to Kay Bailey Hutchinson in a heartbeat. And I think I'm probably the first person who's ever said that, but there you have it.
Well, that's a pretty interesting thought, because it will be, you know, there will be a number of other races, including a lot of judges, you know, in Harris County that are running. But in the rest of the state, there just may be a lot of people that will cross over to be a spoiler, sort of, in a sense.
And that primary will be held in March of next year.
Yes.
If people want to start planning.
Yes. Well, we have lots of elections before that. And of course, coming up is, in speaking of elections, this Wednesday is the endorsement meeting. Now, The Houston GOP political caucus has already endorsed the mayoral race for Anise Parker, but the city council races, the city controller races, and the school board races, all of those endorsements will be made this Wednesday for anybody who was a member or anybody who has been a member that expired within the last year can, you know, join up and participate in that.
That's excellent. And Jack, do you want to say anything about the mayor's race in Houston this year?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, from what I've been reading, it seems like it's a race going to be between Anise Parker, who is part of this community, and Gene Locke. And you know, I was in the screening for all three candidates, and I was actually, you know, and of course I like Anise a lot, but the other two major candidates are also, including Peter Brown, they all screen very well. I mean, Gene Locke has a history of being an activist in the black community from long, long time ago. Peter Brown is a progressive who really believes in neighborhoods and communities and stuff, but Anise Parker has been elected six times now by the city at large, and she has been, you know, city council at large and then controller at large, and she really has the credentials behind her.
Well, Jack, let me make sure I'm getting this frame correctly. Is it possible that Houston is about to elect its first openly lesbian mayor?
Well, we don't want to put the cart before the horse. I mean, more than likely, there, you know, there's three major candidates and probably a couple minor candidates that will run in November, and more than likely there will be a runoff race in December. So, and you know, a runoff race is a brand new race. So it's some people have said it's Anise's race to lose, but it's you know, there's a lot of money to be raised. It's a big city. We're a city of 2.2 million people. So it's all a matter about raising the money, getting people out to vote, and getting your message across. And there's one political commentator keeps saying, well, I want to see the first one who gets on TV. None of that's happened yet. As compared to 6 years ago when Bill White started running ads like in March.
Yeah, but Bill White had several millions of dollars.
Yes.
He had $2 or $3 million in the bank at the time, whereas most of these candidates have, if they've got over $1 million, it's not much more than what, 1.7 was the top in the last reporting session. So no one has the multi-millions that Bill White had. So that's why they're not on TV. It'll be a grassroots campaign. We'll get some TV toward the end, but all of this early campaigning is just going to be one person to another. Small groups.
Absolutely. And here in Houston, people don't focus on these elections until, you know, near the end, because a lot of people are not from here, as compared to like Chicago, where people grew up their whole lives in a city like Chicago. So it's interesting times.
Well, so that is so interesting. And Jack and Jennifer, I just have to ask you one more question, and I know you have to let me go in a minute.
Please, what do you got?
Well, is it as hot down there as what I've been hearing?
Oh, it is so hot, yes. And in fact, you know, a lot of us are thinking, well, it's already fall because, you know, from May through the end of July, it's the hottest period on record for Houston, and it's also been the driest period of record in Houston. Yeah. So, yes, it is, I can't say the word, hot.
Yes, and it's, and we're, as far as rainfall and the drought, we're 20-something inches below what we should normally have.
And in parts of West, mid-Texas and West Texas, it's even worse.
My God, I got a new iPhone, and I programmed it to load up Austin's weather, because Austin is my hometown. And I also programmed it to load up Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's weather, because I love Pittsburgh and I have great friends there.
You know, David, you're weird.
Yeah, I know. I know. And I embrace that.
Yes, me too.
And then when I saw Austin's weather for the next 5 days, I unloaded it because I didn't want that on my iPhone.
It might break it, right.
Well, Lake Travis is the lowest it's ever been since they started built the dam.
Good Lord.
Well, yeah. David, thank you for joining us. It's been an incredible conversation, as usual. Tell us what you do for your day job.
Oh, for my day job, I'm the communications director for U.S. Action. We fight for quality, affordable health care for all. You can see our website at www.usaction.org. And thank you all for having me tonight on Queer Voices.
And David joins us the first Monday of every month to talk about some national issues from Washington. And we'll see you again next month, or we'll hear you again next month. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Christopher David Trentum.
And I'm Chris Cullman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community the week ending August 1st, 2009. Australians, lesbians, gays, and their supporters held a National Day of Action for Marriage Equality in cities across the continent on August 1st, even as the National Conference of the ruling center-left Labour Party in Sydney defeated efforts to change its policies on matrimonial equality. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, an avowedly church-going Christian, has said that same-gender couples deserve rights, but he's also steadfastly repeated his party's election pledge to support a five-year-old federal law defining marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The Labour Party reaffirmed that position at its national conference. Attorney General Robert McClellan thanked Australia's faith communities for their support of his government during a speech to conference delegates, saying that Labour will not support any form of recognition of relationships that undermine marriage. As Aretha Franklin's pop classic Respect blasted from loudspeakers in at least one locale, thousands witnessed mock same-gender wedding ceremonies as part of the National Day of Action in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and other Australian cities. Activists called them the largest mass illegal weddings ever held. They vowed to continue pushing for full marriage rights. Spokesman Alex Greenwich of the advocacy group Australian Marriage Equality told reporters that there's no room to negotiate on equality. Our rights are not an enterprise bargaining agreement.
Meanwhile, Albania's government announced on its official website this week a proposal to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. The announcement said such legislation is necessary to stop discrimination against same-gender couples in the Southeast European nation, although it acknowledged that the proposal may spark debate. Prime Minister Sali Berisha, who was recently re-elected, said the action was prompted by requests from LGBT rights groups and told legislators this week that discrimination against gays and lesbians was unacceptable. His Democrats control more than half of the 140 seats in Parliament. Albania is a predominantly Muslim country, but it's more secular than most similar nations. Strong objections to the proposal, however, have already been voiced by religious leaders and opposition lawmakers. Some critics also believe the move is intended to curry favor with the European Union, which Albania seeks to join. Homosexual acts were punishable there by up to 10 years in prison until 1995. A lesbian activist who identified herself only as Ira told Reuters that the proposal took her group by surprise because they had lobbied only for anti-discrimination laws. If you look at our society, the proposal looks a bit surreal, she said, but we welcome it. If the legislation succeeds, it would make the former communist Balkan state the first in the region to recognize same-gender civil marriage.
But Portugal's constitutional court has ruled that the country's marriage laws are exclusively heterosexual. In a 3-2 vote, the judges upheld lower court rulings that denied a marriage license to a lesbian couple. The plaintiffs had cited a provision in Portugal's constitution that bans discrimination based on sexual orientation. The court said the question before it was not whether the constitution allows same-gender marriages, but whether the constitution compels them to be accepted, which it does not. Activists were encouraged by the split decision, however, saying that progress towards equality was being made in their predominantly Roman Catholic country. Prime Minister José Sócrates and his ruling center-left Socialist Party have included marriage equality in their manifesto in the run-up to national elections on September 27th. Polls indicate that they're facing a strong challenge from the opposition center-right Social Democrats, which opposes such a move.
A 64-year-old lesbian in Israel has been granted a widow's government pension following the death of her longtime partner. The Advocate reported last week that the action followed a lawsuit brought by the widow, Ella Bar-Lian, who was represented by New Family, a national advocacy group that works for family rights. After her partner, Roberta Saltonik, died in September, Bar-Lian applied for a national insurance widow's pension. Her request was rejected on the grounds that she and Saltonik were not spouses, even though they had been together for 22 years. Israeli law only recognizes Jewish marriages performed by the rabbinate, and none will marry same-gender couples. New Family Executive Director Irit Rosenblum said that we will not rest until legislation is enacted giving the rights of all types of families in Israel equal status.
Quakers in the United Kingdom voted this week to rewrite their prayer book to include marriage ceremonies for same-gender couples and called on the government to provide equal marriage rights for such couples. The Quakers, known formally as the Society of Friends, becomes the first mainstream religious group to put same-gender couples on a par with their heterosexual counterparts in Britain, where civil partnerships for gays and lesbians, but not marriage, is the law of the land. More than 1,600 Quakers voted at their annual meeting in York to treat same-sex committed relationships in the same way as opposite-sex marriages. However, the Quakers also called the question of legal recognition by the British government secondary and won't require Quaker registrars to disobey the law by marrying same-gender couples.
The inclusion of open gays and lesbians in religious life has divided the 77 million member global Anglican Communion, the world's third largest Christian denomination after the Roman Catholic and Orthodox churches. Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, suggested this week that the seemingly impossible to surmount split between the more lesbi-gay welcoming U.S. Episcopal and Canadian Anglican regions and traditionalists who support biblical condemnation of homosexuality, primarily in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, may require a two-tiered church. On his website this week, the ecclesiastical leader of the church described two styles of being Anglican whose mutual relation will certainly need working out, but which would not exclude cooperation in mission and service of the kind now shared in the communion.
The sailor accused of brutally murdering gay African-American U.S. Navy seaman August Provost as he served sentry duty on June 30th at Southern California's Camp Pendleton has killed himself while in custody in the base brig. Officials said that Jonathan Campos apparently asphyxiated himself with toilet paper during the afternoon of July 31st, even though he had been on suicide watch and had been checked late that morning. The Navy had charged Campos with murder, drug possession, burglary, and several other crimes. Campos allegedly shot Provost several times while attempting to enter the base to destroy property and attack other sailors. Some of Provost's family members said that he had told them he was being harassed for being gay, but military officials said the two sailors didn't know each other, that there was no evidence that the killing was a hate crime, and that Provost had never filed any complaints. He would have been reluctant to do so, however, under the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
And finally, Salt Lake City prosecutor Sim Gill announced this week that his office won't pursue a case against Derek Jones and Matt Orne, the couple arrested for kissing while gay, as they strolled on a Mormon church-owned but publicly used walkway outside temple grounds in early July. Gill said he dropped the trespassing charges because signs on the downtown Main Street Plaza failed to properly notify visitors that they were entering private property at will, meaning they could be ejected at any time for any reason. Grainy surveillance video released this week doesn't show what precipitated the confrontation, but does show four burly security guards arguing with the couple, finally yanking them apart and putting them in handcuffs. The guards, Orne said this week, told them that their display of affection was disgusting, gross, and wrong. Supporters of the couple have staged two kiss-in demonstrations at the plaza since the arrest, and a similar protest was held outside the Mormon Church Temple in San Diego, California. Citing the Salt Lake City incident and a similar confrontation in El Paso, Texas, bloggers are calling for countrywide protests. The great nationwide kiss-in is scheduled for Saturday, August the 15th. Organizing is reportedly already underway in Boston, New York, Houston, Portland, Oregon, and three California cities, Irvine, San Diego, and San Francisco. A Facebook page promoting the demonstrations says people should be allowed to freely express their affection. The great nationwide kiss-in website is at http://sitin4equality.net. That's http://sitin4equality.net.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending August 1st, 2009. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Coleman.
And I'm Christopher David Trentum.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, before we get into our next interview, I just want to mention that there's a movie that opened this past Friday called Hump Day.
Oh, I want to see that.
I saw the preview.
Oh, you did?
And it was good. I wouldn't say it was great, but I think it was good, and it was an interesting subject.
Isn't it about two guys that are making...
It's two straight guys who were sort of estranged friends, and they get together, and they decided to do a movie for a film festival, and... In that movie, they decided to have sex. It's real interesting, but what's really interesting is that Chronicle gave it 4 stars.
I saw that. 4 stars. I never see 4 stars.
It's really interesting. And whenever you go to these previews, the Chronicle reviewer is usually the last person to show up.
Yeah.
They sometimes have to hold up the movie for him.
4 stars.
Yes, 4 stars, which is interesting. And the movie that's opening this weekend is the one with about the cook.
The cook. Oh, yeah. Julie and Julia. I can't wait to see that.
That looks interesting. So, as we get into this, Tim Brookover is here. He is on the board of the Houston GLBT Community Center.
Not the political caucus.
Good evening.
Just seems to come out there.
Oh, I'm a member of the caucus.
Yes, you are a member of the caucus. We're talking about the third quarterly of this year meeting of the... I still call it the Futures Group because that's what I think of it is, but it's not. You changed the name, which really makes a lot more sense. What are we calling it now, Tim?
We changed the name about a year ago to the Community Leaders Networking Group. But Jack's correct that it grew out of the Futures Conference on LGBTI... Future.
I know we're all getting our stuff mixed up tonight, but that's okay because it's all related.
It's all related,
it's
right?
It's all good. Yeah.
A conference that was held in, what was that, 95?
Somewhere around there.
2000.
And, you know, I was part of that organizing of thing, but I didn't go to it because I was so busy organizing Pride at the time.
Right.
But it was Phyllis Fry and Ray Hill, and it was the town hall meeting. Three, I think, because there was actually, I think, a second one.
I think you're right.
And town halls happened in the late 70s.
It was 79?
Yes, it was like the first precursor of Pride.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that town hall meeting that was held at the Astra Hall, I believe, the Montrose Counseling Center, the Montrose Clinic, which is now Legacy, and a number of other organizations sort of formed, were birthed out of that, the original birthers.
The original birthers, right.
And those two organizations, of course there's other ones, are going incredibly strong nowadays. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Montrose Counseling Center has a building of their own.
Right.
Legacy is going to be building a building of their own because they've grown so much, and they all sort of want to centralize in one area. So, and that was definitely before my time, that these foundations in the community were put in place, and they're still going strong.
I didn't know that came out of the town hall meeting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I know it was about 30 years ago that this all happened, but, yeah, that makes sense.
Kind of a lot of the energy from that meeting led to the creation of some of these groups. Then fast forward to 2005, not 1995, as I said earlier. The latest Futures Conference was held. And then after that event, as I've explained in history before, the community center, the GLBT Community Center, realized that there really wasn't a plan in place to follow up on the Futures Conference. And so we decided to host a quarterly meeting of people in the community who had been involved in the conference to discuss many of the resolutions that had been put forward at the conference on all kinds of subjects, from sports to faith and religion to health to politics, just the future of our organizations. But then an interesting thing happened as we met quarterly. The people who were participating in the group really wanted a venue where people could come together in an informal atmosphere and talk. Mm-hmm. Talk about the community, talk about the organizations, compare information, compare notes, ask questions, ask for advice, swap stories and gossip. And so that's really where the quarterly meeting has landed.
Right, and you do not actually have to be a community leader to be there.
It's not like a badge you wear that I am a community leader.
No, your badges are not checked at the door. And as Ray Hill, one of our regular participants, says, you can either be a leader who is chosen in some way, or you can be a self-appointed leader.
and Ray should know about.
And Ray should know about both. Or you don't have to consider yourself a leader at all. It's open to everyone in the community. We encourage everyone to come. It's very informal. It's very very casual. It's this Saturday, August 8th, from 1 to 5 p.m. at the community center. But wait, before you say a four-hour meeting,
right?
No. Nobody is required or even expected to come for the entire afternoon. The meeting just kind of grew that way, where the more people would come and people just wanted to continue to talk, and we expanded the hours. The way it is now, some people come early and chat and leave. Some people come late and chat and leave. Some people come in the middle and chat and leave. Some people participate, leave, come back. It's completely free form. We just try to work people in as they're there if they want to talk. Not everybody wants to talk, but if you want to talk and you show up, you know, we'll put you in the rotation to talk. So I know last month, particularly a friend of ours in the community was a bit disturbed when he showed up, and he felt like he was expected to be there for 4 hours. And I said, no, we don't take roll. You could leave.
You'll get credit if you leave.
Right, you still get credit. Yeah. But, you know, you don't have to stay for the whole 4 hours. I'm there the whole 4 hours, and some of the other diehards are there, such as Jack, are frequently there the whole 4 hours. But
I attended not this past one, but the one before that, and what I got out of it was you get people in the room that are kind of working in their nonprofits, and they're doing their own thing, and you get to compare notes, and like, okay, well, how did you do this? Or, you know, you can kind of combine resources and kind of, not, you know, kind of do that collaborative thing.
Networking.
Yeah.
Network.
Exactly.
Well, and one of the nice things that I like about it, and I'm one of the people who's involved in, you know, like all of us, involved in multiple organizations and with, you know, multiple demands and multiple meetings to attend and events to attend. This is one of the few times, as Sally Huffer, the Counseling Center, has pointed out, this is one of the few times, maybe the only time, when many of us can get together where there's no agenda.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
No money to be raised. You don't have to pay attention to a speaker. There's not a set program. There's nothing that's expected at the end. It's just very informal, and I like that about it.
I like the informalness too, because you just talk and then kind of your conversations kind of veer off and kind of go down a path.
Right. And the content is dictated really strictly by whoever's there. If someone is there from Bayou City Performing Arts, we might have, you know, more of an art-related component to the afternoon.
You know, there was an article written in the New York Times, and I posted it on Lone Star Activist, and I really, unfortunately, haven't gotten to read it myself. It was talking about the generational gap within the community. And I think, you know, that's something we have talked about and somewhat addressed. Certainly, we don't have the answers for that. No. And there's always sort of been that generational divide within the community, although I think it might be a little bit wider right now. That was something that was really interesting to talk about.
Now, was this in the gay community or just
in
generation?
Yes.
Well, I'll have to go back and read that, because that's a tremendous issue in our community, and as it is, I think, in a lot of communities, particularly in ours. And part of that has to do with the fact that, at least in the male community, that there was an entire generation that we lost
that is not here,
and so there's an even bigger gap between some of the older. Some of the older gays and some of the younger gays.
We have the older generation that fought hard for rights, and, you know, the blood was pouring on the streets of Montrose, as Ray would say. And then you have the younger generation that is the queerest folk generation, as I call it. Everything is free and open, and society is accepting, and you know, there's not that struggle.
Right.
And the newer generation isn't as exposed to HIV/AIDS and seen the deaths, so they're kind of...
Well, and some people in the older generation had these walls built up because they were, you know, they had to live, even in cities like Houston, they had to live in the closet in some respect, for so many reasons. And, I mean, just look at how the city has changed so much politically.
Right.
So those things, you know, we're still dealing with. And then, as Brian was said, there's a middle part of that generational divide that's not even around.
Like 40s. 50s.
Right. Yeah, so it's a big issue, and that's something that we've discussed, I know, more than once in the networking group meeting of, you know, how to attract the young people, well, as some of the old folks like me say.
A good call out to the younger listeners. If you're listening, come this.
And there's actually another thing, how to not exclude the older generation.
Well, and that too. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, and that's also, that's an issue that, you know, many of the elders in our community, and, you know, God willing, I'll be there one day. But
many years from now.
Many, too. Thank you, Brian, many years. Not so many, but a few. But is that isolation?
Yeah.
You know, that I think is something that a lot of older people face anyway, but that in our community it's even worse.
Well, in the gay community.
Can be worse.
Youth is prized. And
particularly among the male community.
Yes.
But I think even, you know, across the board. And that's of course, a reflection of the larger culture, I mean,
yeah,
in the United States.
But it's amplified in the gay community.
Oh, absolutely. It's you know, I think in some ways it's, you know, you'd like to think as we go along year by year we evolve, but I don't think that's gotten any better. I think that's, you know, in some ways it's even worse.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's something that we've talked about at the networking group. And, you know, we don't necessarily come up with answers, but we're not there to come up with answers.
Yeah.
But it's a great way to
just
talk.
Just discussing. And when you're talking, kind of, it may spur an answer, you know.
Well, one of the nice things, and to play off something that you said, Brian, is I think one of the best things about the group is it's created some connections, mm-hmm, among organizations that might not have otherwise
existed. It's funny, we have these organizations that are kind of like pillars where we work independently, and you know, there could be more collaboration within the,
right,
the, you know, through the community and networking,
and you know,
this provides that.
Yeah, and because we're all working so hard, I mean, yeah, everybody's just working so hard to keep their organizations going and keep their services going. And
keep our community together.
Try to keep our community together. But it's nice to see on a couple of occasions people say, well, you know what? We're working on that too. Or that's, yeah, something that I'd like some help with. And there have been a couple of occasions where I know some groups have you know, come together and partnered in part, you know, through the networking group, which I think has
well, and we're also under some challenges now with the economy, that a number of our organizations are having a tough time making it, or trying to keep staff if they have staff.
Absolutely.
And finding volunteers because people are so focused on trying to keep their job. And also the fact that the community is changing. We're not all, you know, centered in Montrose, or that, you know, is there even a need for some of these organizations like there was in the past?
Right. Well, and it's, you know, it's, there's a, and we've talked about this around this table before too. I mean, there's a big sea change going on in the community, and I think one of the frightening things about it is none of us, or maybe few of us, only the most visionary of us, can really see where that's going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
What is the community going to look like in 10, 20, 30 years?
We're
going to
be all over the city, I think.
We will be.
Little pockets and
that's not
little
necessarily
colonies.
A bad thing.
No, no.
But of course, many of the organizations that, you know, that some of us grew up with aren't going to be here anymore. In some cases, that will be just an evolutionary thing. It won't be a bad thing. But in some cases, it will be a shame because they may have provided services that are needed, but it's tough out
there. Well, and one of the institutions that we don't have in this community is a weekly newspaper,
which is a, even now, it was so many of us getting our news off the internet. It's a tremendous void in the community.
It's nice to look at it and kind of get your coffee and like read and like, oh, I didn't know that, you know.
Well, and what's, I mean, and we compare it to Dallas, which The Dallas Voice has two full-time news reporters
that
actually research, write stories, and as much as Outsmart does a great job in what it does do, it is not a newspaper.
Yeah.
It's a monthly magazine that does some good pieces, but it doesn't report the news.
Yeah. And that's just such a loss, and... The Voice folded, what, 2 years ago, 3 years
ago? Was it 2 years ago?
Wow. But, you know, even more and more, I think we realize what a loss that is, because it was another way for us to get the word out and also to communicate with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when, you know, we certainly saw this when the hurricane hit last year. A lot of us who maybe depended on the internet couldn't get our news,
right?
And couldn't get community news because we didn't have any power, and there was not any weekly newspaper to say, hey, you know, if you're in the GLBT community and you need some help, here are some resources, on that weekly basis. And by the time a monthly magazine comes out, I mean it's too late. So that's that's a big loss, and that's not going to come back. Just the way
Do you think it's just the evolution of the way we get news and the newspapers are going away?
And particularly, I shouldn't never say never, but I mean, it's going to take somebody with a lot of money.
It would be very difficult for a newspaper to start in this economy and the way things are going on the web. I think it's hard enough for the newspapers around the country that are there to struggle to stay.
Well, I mean, look at the Chronicle.
Yes,
On a Monday or Tuesday, the Chronicle is, six pages.
The combined
business and metro section.
It's terrible.
I think that's the trend nationwide. There's a lot of big papers that are...
And a lot of magazines aren't.
We're moving away from that paper print media.
But again, it's also our community is, reflective of the larger culture. We don't know where that's going to end up.
Well, and that was like a tangible piece of our history, because you could get a tweet or a Houston Voice or what have you, and it would be like the ads, and there would be people, and it would kind of be a snapshot in time.
That's a very good point.
A chronicled history, and I miss it.
So, as we're going to be meeting at the community center, what's in the future for the community center?
Well, it's been a very challenging year for us over the past year. Like I know it has been for a lot of organizations, and not just because of the economy, but some of us on the board have had some challenges in our personal life, and then of course that hurricane hit. And I think a lot of people don't realize that the building that we're in really suffered some pretty serious damage. You could never really see it from the outside, but it was inside the building. So we're a little bit in a rebuilding mode, but we're excited. We've got some. We're gearing up for some stuff to happen in the fall. The Community Leaders Networking Group continues. We're working toward bringing back some of our programs that were very successful and people liked, a monthly community center dinner night, which will happen at a restaurant once a month. We're going to turn over some of our space to an art gallery where community artists can show their work and sell their work.
That's good.
We see that there's a real need for that. It's very difficult for artists to make a living.
Do we have anything like that now?
We don't. We really don't.
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of galleries that.
But you're going to focus on that, GLBT artists.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. We're also working with QFest, which some people still know as the Houston Lesbian and Gay Community Film Festival. Sorry. I had contacted Marion Luntz at the film curator at the Museum of Fine Arts a few weeks ago and said, hey, QFest is coming up. The Community Center would love to maybe show something in collaboration, at the same time.
You could show the Montrose, the documentary that the Montrose Counseling Center did.
We could possibly do that. Well, it turns out QFest is not happening. The museum is not showing QFest films this month or this year.
I had not heard that.
And so I contacted... Well, I'd been in contact also with Christian Salinas, the executive director who lives in Los Angeles. And at any rate, to make a long story short, the community center is going to work with QFest to probably screen at least one film, probably in October, probably at another venue, just to keep the QFest name out there.
I would hate to see that go away.
It would too. And we're just we're just going to try to help keep QFest alive, keep the name going, and hopefully they can rebuild as an another organization that needs to be rebuilt.
Right. So okay,
put that on the injured list.
Right.
All right, so let's recap. The community leadership meeting is this Saturday.
The Community Leaders Networking Group meets Saturday, August 8th at the Houston GLBT Community Center, 3400 Montrose. We're on the second floor, suite 207.
That's the Skybar building for
That's
people.
That's the Skybar. Or if you're of a certain age, you remember it as the Cody's building.
Ah, yes.
And parking?
Parking is in the parking garage adjacent to the building, and during the day, it's free. At night, the bar, the Sky Bar, charges, but it's always free to community center participants, but certainly during the day, there's no charge.
Great. Okay. So we look forward to seeing you all this Saturday at 1 p.m., and you can be there. You can show up any time between 1 and 5 p.m.
Right. And you can stay if you like, or you can come for a few minutes.
And it's not that big of a meeting. I mean, you can really participate.
Yeah. We encourage everybody to participate, and if you want to come and talk about your organization or what efforts you're involved with, feel free.
Sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge to get a word in when Ray's speaking, but we all learn how to deal with that.
Right. He's got to throw words in, pepper them in every once in a while.
So we'll see you this Saturday. Tim, thank you for joining us this
evening. Jack and Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
And coming up next on Queer Voices, Joan Devlin will be joining us from Iowa to talk about the author of a book called Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. KPFT Houston.
Where does our food come from? How's the industrialization of food affecting our lives? It's less expensive to purchase a burger, fries, and soda at a fast food restaurant than it is to buy a head of organic broccoli. What are solutions? What are questions you ask yourself about the food you eat and serve to friends and family? Ecology, Wednesday at 6 a.m., interviews Elise Perlstein, writer and co-producer of the documentary Food, Inc. Food, Inc. examines agribusiness, big food. Also joining us at the station will be Stacy Rossell, a local family farmer. We're going to be talking about your food. Last week, Monica Pope, chef and co-founder of Midtown Farmers Market, asked us to prepare two meals a week using ingredients purchased from local farmers and advises us to eat where our food lives. Ecology, Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston's program dedicated to the environment, ecology, social justice, health, spirit, and your food. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
90.1 FM at Howl in the Blues proudly present A Howl in the Heights. Hey, this is the Blues Hound inviting you to join us on Sunday, September 27th at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, located at 1031 East 24th Street in the Heights. This is going to be a special show benefiting your listener-sponsored community radio, 90.1 FM. $10 is going to get you in the door to hear the music of the Space City Aces and the Brad Absher Band. Once again, that's A Howl in the Heights, Sunday, September 27th from 4 to 7. Doors open at 3. Come on, get off the porch and run with the big dogs. Ow! KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
So, Joan, we're still working on getting your guest for you. So, how are things in Iowa right now?
Oh, well, we're supposed to have some bad weather, but other than that, they're pretty good.
Okay, and your guest is on now, too.
Excellent.
Good evening.
We are talking tonight to Frederick Hertz, the author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. And the thing I liked about Making It Legal is, actually, it's kind of a how-to book. And Mr. Hertz, if you could tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write this book that goes through everything from what marriage is for GLBT people, as well as divorces and property and children and everything else you could think of.
And also what to do for to legalize your partnership if you're in a state that can't marry. Well, basically what was happening is in the last 2 years, it seems like almost every week the law has been changing, even in California, what you can do, what you can't do. And I get so many calls from all over the country, and one of the things I realized is I've decided there's a new form of legal discrimination. Discrimination in the form of legal complexity. And as I sat there explaining to people what the law was today, tomorrow, yesterday, I realized that people needed actually a simple primer on the basics so that when they start facing specific questions and specific problems, they understand the big picture background.
Right, because we are, you know, Iowa just passed, and they just accepted gay marriage, or I guess a couple of months ago. And, you know, we've already had situations of people coming here from other states, and there's all kinds of questions surrounding that. Because, you know, if you come here from Illinois or from Wisconsin, you're legally married in Iowa, but as soon as you go home, you know, what's the status then?
Yes, and in fact, the problem of non-recognition is a huge problem. In fact, we have a whole chapter on it in the book. There's a problem of federal non-recognition, and then there's a problem of state-to-state non-recognition. And this is something that straight couples don't have to worry about. The main thing we have to tell people is that if you live in a non-recognition state, meaning a state that doesn't have marriage or domestic partnership or explicit law that recognizes it, you are the test case. When people say to me, what's going to happen in the law, I have to turn them and say, you know, you call me back when the court rules on your case, and then I'll know the answer. Because we've just never had this situation before. What I have to tell people is you should assume your legal partnership is not going to be recognized, and therefore you should do things like an adoption or wills or property agreements so you have a private system set up, because you can't count on the government recognizing your relationship.
And I guess this would even apply to people who are in states that recognize and accept gay marriage, because you have to live on the assumption that, you know, unless you're planning on staying in, you know, Iowa or Massachusetts or wherever for the rest of your life, you could still run into these issues at some
point. Absolutely. You could face a non-recognition problem by moving there. And in fact, I recently met with a couple that was considering a job. They were living in California. One job offer was in New Hampshire. One job offer was in Utah. Utah is a total non-recognition state. New Hampshire is a marriage and domestic partner recognition state. And at the end of the 2 hours, I basically said, you know, we should just postpone doing your legal agreements till you tell me what state you're going to live in, because otherwise I'm going to have to write an agreement, as I have done actually, that said, if you move to Alabama, for example, this is what the arrangement will be. I even had a couple where they agreed that if they should ever move to a certain state, they would actually contractually agree that one of them would move back to California to resolve their legal problems, because they were going to be raising kids, and one of the women was afraid that the state they were moving to wouldn't recognize their parental relationship. So they even put in their contract that one of them would pay the expense of moving them back to California, where they would have a friendlier court system. That's how complicated it gets.
And I wanted to ask you another question, and we are talking to the author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions, Mr. Frederick Hertz. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, so I'm in Iowa, I'm married, it's all legal, but there's, you know, I don't move anywhere, but there's the issue of traveling, because we've all heard the horror stories of people that are married, their marriages are recognized. You know, they go on a family fun vacation to another state, something goes wrong, and suddenly they have no rights.
Well, there's a terrible situation that just happened with a lesbian on a Olivia Cruz, I think it was Olivia Cruz, stopped in Florida. Her partner had a stroke, and the hospital wouldn't let her in, even though they were registered domestic partners. What people say, and, you know, I can't say that I do it myself, but I tell other people to do it, is have a power of attorney. Even if you're married or registered, have a privately signed power of attorney, and you can either make a copy of it and bring it with you, or there now are document registry services where you can post your documents online, and so wherever you find yourself, you can download them. And if you use, for example, a conventional medical authorization, that will be recognized even if the hospital does not recognize the legality of your partnership.
So, you know, this brings us to the broader question, because as we get our rights, our marriage rights, state by state, you know, it actually seems like it becomes more complex rather than less complex.
Well, having no rights at all is actually quite simple. You know, I jokingly said that when I first started going to gay legal conferences 25 years ago, there only seemed to be two issues. Will the guys get arrested for sex in the park, and will the women have their kids taken away? That was a very simple time. It was not a very happy time. So the way I try to look at it, and I tell this to my clients all the time, we are in the midst of social change. Social change in this country is messy. It's complicated. And if you choose to have a full life of kids and houses and mortgages and loans and businesses, you are going to have to take on a level of education and a level of legal burden that your straight colleagues don't have to. And one of the things I'm always trying to tell people is you need to talk to your straight friends and tell them what you're going through. But I welcome this complexity, even though it makes, you know, my brain gets a little fried at times. But I'd much rather have this complexity than the simplicity of no rights at all.
And I guess maybe, you know, the fact that you're kind of laying it out like that and you're being very direct about it, because you mentioned in your book that, you know, people who know you often brand you as the anti-marriage lawyer. So, you know, why is that moniker applied to you? Is it because you are so blunt and so direct and letting people know it's not all sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows? It is going to be a struggle?
Right. I mean, first of all, statistically, most relationships will end. And you know, actually, I remember back in the gay community when having a relationship end was not the end of the world. This is not a failed marriage. People can have serial relationships, and I don't want to so adopt the straight normative model that I say you have to partner with somebody at age 18 and stay with them, you know, to age 85. It works for some people. My parents just celebrated their 65th wedding anniversary. I'm a big fan of long-term relationships, but I think people have to work with the assumption, A, that the law is not always on their side, and B, more likely than not, they will part ways. And so what I want people to do is see those realities, see those truths, and I actually believe that if you plan accordingly, you'll probably stay together longer. So, but I am seen as the anti-marriage lawyer because I'm always saying, oh, what about the divorce? What about the divorce? So, for example, let me just say one quick thing. I just have to plug my website, which is makingitlegal.net, not .com, .net. And I just wrote a piece on my blog there about joint liability for debts, a big issue now. You know, if you legally partner, you're on the hook for your partner's debts in most states. And you don't have to get married. If your partner is a deadbeat who doesn't pay his bills, you are better to stay unmarried to that person.
And I was going to ask about, what about divorce? Because, you know, unfortunately, where there's marriage, there will be divorce. It's kind of an equation. You know, and as Ray Hill used to say, you know, back in the day, you divided, you know, the TV, the clothes, the cat, you know, whatever. But as you're stating, it's a little bit more complicated now, particularly if you go through a situation where there's children involved.
Right. So, and what is really crucial, and it's very difficult, which is that if you're in a state that doesn't allow a second parent adoption, or if you're in a state like Texas that doesn't recognize a legal partnership, you have to write your own contract, and you have to do it yourself. And I would say that given how complex our lives have gotten, I think people need to think about their partnering in different ways. I jokingly say that, you know, now that there's joint liability of debt for debts, you need to start asking a different set of questions of your partner than you may have wanted to ask 5 years ago.
Well, and the other thing is, I would think, you know, as painful as it sounds, and you talk about prenups too, but, you know, the time to be deciding all this and working all these details out is not when you're in the midst of a relationship that's broken up and there may be hard feelings and other issues. So it's kind of sad to say it, but you almost have to, when you are about to enter into the marriage, think about, well, what do we do if this doesn't work out, which is a
hard thing to do. I don't find it sad. I find it a kind of caretaking. You know, I guess if you're willing to, if you're able to say, you know, most of my clients have accepted the fact that they will eventually die, and to say, I want you to be taken care of if we die, if I die, or for me to say, you know, if I should have a falling out with my boyfriend, I don't want him living on the street. I find that a loving form of caretaking. I don't find it sad to want to take care of things any more than writing a will makes one sad about one's going to die. These are the truths of life, and you can either take care of it in a loving way, or you can wait and do it in a nasty way.
I almost think people are superstitious, though, to where they say, well, see, you know, start talking about getting divorced before we even get married, you know, it's like a jinx or something.
Well, if you talk to people who've gotten divorced, chances are none of their divorces were caused by talking about them ahead of time. You know, and actually people say that, but I think it's actually something different, which is actually quite interesting. I don't think people want to reveal how they really feel. I mean, if you say to your girlfriend, you know, I really want to help you out, and I really want to pay for you to go to graduate school, or I really want to help you with your business, or set, or, you know, buy you a car for your business, but if you have an affair, I want it all back. That's not always a very easy thing for someone to hear. So I actually think the reason people don't want to talk about this stuff is they actually don't want to look into themselves to say, okay, if I was dumped for another man or another woman, would I be able to live up to my generosity, or would I want it back?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd want it back.
I think that's where we all start.
Yeah.
I think that's where we all start. And, you know, part of the other thing that I feel strongly about, and maybe I'm showing my age, I'm 57, you know, we come from a community that has actually accepted non-monogamy. We've accepted multiple relationships. We've accepted, you know, multi-party, polyamorous relationships. I think we could actually have some things we could teach the straight community by saying we are actually not afraid of dealing with breaking up, and we're going to do it actually in a respectable way. I would love to have a year where there were no ugly gay divorces and only ugly straight divorces.
Right. Well, I think, you know, as being part of the gay community, too, because we haven't always had the option of marriage, we've also, you know, there's a lot of gay people, and even gay people that have been in relationships for many, many years that are like, no, I'm not getting married. I mean, I know them here. You know, as soon as it became legal in Iowa, you'd ask them, are you getting married? No, we've already been together this long. We're fine.
Right. Well, my partner and I are together 27 years without being married.
You know,
and we liked it. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book also was I did not want
to commemorate your relationship in some way, whereas in the gay community, it's kind of like, we're fine if we do it, we're fine if we don't.
Yeah. I want people to actually be able to look at this as a choice. One of the things I've often said is I don't know any straight people who got married just because they had the right to, and their percentages aren't that high. So I do want couples to be able to say it's a choice, it's not a duty.
Joan, are you still there?
Did we lose her?
I guess we did. Yeah, it looks like she's calling back in here on another line.
Okay.
There we go. Joan, is that you?
Yeah.
Okay,
good.
Ahead.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. Sorry about that. Cell phone.
It's all right. All I was saying was that I want people to really see marriage as a choice, not as a duty. And I don't want to recreate the heterosexual norm that says if you are unmarried, somehow that means your relationship is second rate.
Well, and the other thing I think, and as I've talked to my friends about it too, we talk about with younger individuals, because I'm 45 myself, I would hate to see it also just become like something to do. You know, oh, we can get married now, so let's just do it, you know. And
right.
I worry well.
About the longevity of those marriages.
Well, because like you said, of all the legal issues involved, you know, because it's not as simple as you said of, you know, having a relationship, you know, enjoying yourself and then moving on a year later or whatever. There are legal issues involved. There, like you said, debts and property.
There also are interpersonal issues. One of the things that Lee Badgett, who's this great scholar from UCLA, she's just done a study of gay marriage law and practice in the Netherlands. And what she said, what she has found is gay people did not change marriage in the Netherlands. Marriage has changed gay people. It's actually given, it's in good ways and bad ways, it's led people to take their relationships more seriously, which is good. It has let them, it has created more stability, but it has also created a sense of normalcy and family interconnectedness and being a part of an extended family in a way that can be sometimes claustrophobic for some couples.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a commitment. Commitment can be a scary thing for people. I mean,
yeah.
We know that.
Right. And it means, and, I mean, part of what I have to sometimes deal with couples who have what I call a consumer approach to relationships, which is that when their partner turns out to be defective, they want to return him. And part of what I'm hoping to cultivate in the book also is people having a sense of what does it mean to take care of somebody. What, you know, the old jargon, for better or worse, is what marriage really means. And it's actually quite hard. You know, it's very tempting when somebody is out of a job, having a drug problem, being difficult, having a family problem. It's very tempting to want to say, oh, I got a lemon, I'm going to return them.
Yeah.
But if we're going to have our relationship survive, and if we really want to embrace the concept of marriage, we really have to take this for better or for worse pledge seriously.
Joan, you have 2 minutes.
Okay, I was going to say, and a great way to start is with your book, Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions by Frederick Hertz. And is the book out yet, or is it?
It is out. You can buy it at the NOLO.com, NOLO.com. Amazon is still holding it for about a week or so. And as I said, if you look at Making It Legal, all one word, .net, you can have access to buying the book, access to my blog, and access to more information about me, and I hope people will visit the site.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking to Frederick Hurst, the author of Making It Legal. It is an absolutely wonderful book, a must-have for anybody who's in a relationship or would like to be in one. And this is Queer Voices. Thank you so much, Mr. Hurst.
Thank you so much for your interest in our book.
Thank you.
This is Queer Voices.
This is Brian Lamica.
And Jennifer Renee.
And we are shifting gears a little bit to talk about one of our communities.
Is that that scratching sound I heard?
That is...
Oh, okay.
We're changing gears here. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Just checking.
We're talking about one of our community's blessed organizations, one of our better ones, Impact Houston. And with us tonight, we have James Oxford, the publicity director of Impact Houston. Hello, James.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Hey.
Very good.
Good to see you again.
You too.
I think
Thank you.
We last spoke, y'all were planning some things, and so this is, you have an upcoming fundraiser coming?
That's right.
This weekend, right?
Yes, this coming weekend. That's
Tell us all about it.
Okay, well, it's called Sizzling Summer Soiree, and I think a lot of times with activist-type groups, you know, there's a lot of negative issues that we're dealing with and that we're working with. And so this is something a little bit more on the lighter side, to have a little bit of fun. And so
not quite as serious?
Not quite as serious.
Some
have a good time.
Fun stuff is good. I like fun times. Yeah.
Get more people involved and everything. And so, but raise some money at the same time.
Right. So there are tickets. We can't really discuss the price, but where can one get tickets?
They can just go to impact-houston.com, and there's a link there for them. And then just click on that and purchase tickets there.
So what is Impact Houston?
Impact Houston is an activist group who focuses primarily on GLBT issues, but not necessarily always. So they started back in November after the Prop 8. That was really their first event when they had the rally downtown. And so they try to do a lot of other events like that around the city, but they're also trying to reach out to other community organizations like the Transgender Center and things like that. And even organizations outside the GLBT community.
It seems to me that the Impact Houston is more of the younger generation, and not that I'm old, but
well, I am one of the older members myself, actually. But you know,
and you're only 16, right?
He looks 16.
Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the few 16-year-olds with gray hair. But But, you know, I will say that when we have some of our events, one of the great things to see is a large group of young people, and that's good to get them involved and get
Absolutely.
Them aware. But we have a lot of other people of all other ages as well, so it's a good mix.
So what can we expect at this weekend event?
Well, this event is going to, once you purchase your ticket, it includes the foods and the drinks. They have a swimming pool. It's at the Lovett Inn.
Okay.
And
I was
going to
ask where it was.
Yeah,
we mentioned everything
exactly.
but that.
It's
just right down the street from us here.
Right down the street, and so they have a swimming pool there, so they're swimming if anybody wants to go swimming, and then we're also going to be holding a silent auction as well.
I see. So is it just kind of a mixer to kind of get the word out? And
it is, absolutely. It's just raise some money for the organization so they can continue to do what they do, but then also just get more people involved. And I think sometimes you need to have fun events to get people involved and let them learn, and then
exactly,
you know.
Well, you have to get people's attention sometimes so you can educate them on the good work that y'all do. Mm-hmm. I thought it was amazing that when you did have the rally downtown after Prop 8,
right.
that in a matter of a couple of days, you know, you had this incredible number of people out there, and they weren't all young people. We're
Absolutely.
Talking about families, GLBT families with their children and all, which was absolutely remarkable. So your organization does a great deal of good work. So anybody that has an opportunity this weekend, it would be worthwhile to get out there and go to it. Impact-Houston.
Impact-Houston.com. That's correct.
Now, if we have listeners out there that want to get involved and become an activist, mm-hmm. Who could they talk to? Where? How can they get more involved?
Well, I would send them back to the same website as uh-huh. well. Also, if they're on Facebook, a lot of the younger people are. They have a page there as well. Megan Baker is the one that really heads up that organization.
Yes. She's that little dynamo.
She's
a dynamo. She really is.
She's out there.
I wish I had half that energy.
She makes me feel like I'm not. I'm like, golly.
She makes me feel like I'm standing still.
Wow. She makes me very sleepy.
Yes.
So they can go to that website and or contact me or contact Megan. You know, we're always looking for new people. So
absolutely.
And also on a side note, on Sunday it's from 2 to 5 p.m. Just
okay,
throw
so
that out there.
Yeah, let's rehash it. It's 2 to 5 p.m. at mm-hmm. the Lovett Inn
on Sunday, August 9th.
And what's that address at the Lovett Inn?
I want to say.
Well, we're 419 Lovett, and it's one
like,
block.
It's, let's say like 319 ish.
It's actually 501.
Oh, okay. So
it's, no, you got the wrong direction on that. It's
well,
west
I'm,
goes up.
I'm gay, and you know we are as a people are not very good with directions.
Oh, please.
We have, okay, so 501 Lovett. Yes.
It's and all right, let's do it again. 2 to 5
p.m.
Lovett Inn at 501 Lovett
Boulevard. That's right.
And
so, what is the address? Or I mean, what is the attire? I mean,
it's going to be very casual. Like I said, some people will want to go to swim. Some people, but you know, of course, it's going to be 2 to 5. So it's going to be pretty
casual.
Houston casual.
Okay.
That's right.
Sizzling heat. Yes.
Exactly. I would recommend shorts.
Now, what's the temperature supposed to be like? 90s. Again,
I believe so.
Excuse me. It's going to be in the 90s till October.
You know, I was in Chicago this last weekend. It was 75. And we had to wear like almost a sweater at night. It was
rub it in.
I know.
Go
ahead
and rub it in.
Then come back to Houston. I
don't care.
Like, the oppressive heat.
I don't want to hear it. I've got to stay
but,
here.
You know,
I don't want to hear
it. I love Houston and for all of its, you know, heat. We have heat now in the summer so we can have a nice winter. So
that's right.
We have to get
that's
there.
Right.
But that's appropriate that you have the sizzling summer soiree.
That's right. Because it will be.
Yes, it will be.
Now, there's something else going on.
On August 15th.
August 15th.
Yes.
Now, this is the Kiss-In.
Tell us
about
this.
And what's it called, the Kiss-In, for why reason? What is it happening here?
Well, a lot of times people feel that even though more and more people are starting to be a little bit more open about their relationships and everything, they still feel very uncomfortable in public, showing any sort of affection towards each other, holding hands, kissing.
That's my
like
partner,
that.
David, if you're listening.
Exactly. And so this is actually a nationwide event that
really?
Is being co-sponsored by Join the Impact, which is Impact Houston was kind of patterned after that. So Houston is kind of the Houston version of the national organization of Join the Impact. And so across the city, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Boston, they're all going to be staging these events at the same time. And it's literally just going to be a group of people from around Houston getting together, you know, I don't care if you're a heterosexual, you know, heterosexual couple. Everyone come out and support each other. Yeah. And at 1 p.m. on August 15th at Discovery Green.
Now, I had one important question.
Okay.
Do you have to bring somebody to kiss?
I don't think that you do.
Oh, good.
You know.
I might show up then. I've been having problems in that. No one seems to want to.
Oh, Jennifer.
I mean, it's so sad.
Anyway, we're going to have a special show for Jennifer.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have a fun razor.
Yes.
We'll just build you a kissing booth.
Oh, perfect. I love it. We can part of the fundraiser.
Is this event in response to, what was it, the two guys that were kissing in a restaurant?
It was in El Paso.
Yes, right. And here in Texas, and there was
a big to do, and you know, oh, the evil gays are kissing in public. Bah.
Absolutely, and I think that was just kind of one thing that just brought to light that type of issue. So
we're trying to build a more, I guess, acceptance.
Yeah, just acceptance, tolerance, you know, and then. Even outside that, just us within the community feeling more comfortable with who we are.
Yeah.
And expressing it.
Well, I think it's important that, you know, not only in our community, but the community at large, that we feel comfortable showing affection to one another.
Right.
I mean, I know some heterosexual couples that don't show very much affection.
Right.
And because it's something about public displays of affection.
Exactly.
And there's a mindset that you shouldn't do that. It sort of permeates itself within the GLBT community. And it's not. Show your affection. It's not against the law.
And there are parts of town where I don't feel comfortable.
I don't know. In Houston, maybe it is against the law.
Yeah, and you know, in the Montrose.
Better check that.
In Midtown area, you know, I feel pretty comfortable. But, you know, if you leave the comfort of the loop.
Yes. Have you discussed with the police department about the hugging and kissing on Discovery Green?
I have not personally. I mean, we're still working out the details, but I don't believe there's any city.
Well, you know, Denise can bring her partner, and she can.
Absolutely.
That would be cool.
Absolutely. But it's kind of one of those things. It's along the line of, you can't expect anyone else to accept you if you don't accept
exactly.
yourself, you know.
Which is the point I was trying to make.
Yeah,
We just need to show love.
We need to love ourselves before we can love each other.
That's right.
Now, are you prepared for protesters, those who don't believe in kissing?
Absolutely. You know, and that's one thing that's been a surprise for us, and we really do need to be ready for, is that of all the events that we've had, we've always been prepared. Oh, there's going to be the people out there just, you know, protesting everything we do. And we have yet to really have a really negative response to anything that we've done up to this point. We're always have that in the back of our mind.
You haven't been doing anything about health care.
That's right.
You know, if you were doing health care, you'd probably get the wackadoodles coming to town.
I saw some protesters at Pride. You know, of course, they were outnumbered. And then the week after Pride, like 1 week after, they were still at the corner of Montrose and Westheimer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, you know, God, you know, da 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 da, you know.
The American Wackadoodle Society.
Yeah, and I'm like, why did you pick this corner? You know, is this a special corner?
Yeah. Well, they had protesters today in Baytown, actually, matter of fact, protesting. Or speaking towards, you know, that marriage should only be between men and women. And
why Baytown? I don't understand.
I have no idea, to be honest. I just heard that when I was leaving work today. I saw a message on Facebook today saying there was protesters down in Baytown. So why there, I'm not sure.
And why Baytown?
It's I guess, holier than? I don't know.
If anybody knows, just send us an email. Let us know what that was all about down in Baytown.
Jesus lives in Baytown. I'm just kidding.
Be careful.
I know, right?
You know.
Yes, I'm kidding.
We want to stay on the air.
Yes.
He didn't mean it. We've already been bombed. We've been shot at. We've been burned.
Do we have any listeners? No.
Has it been at this location?
Oh, yes. That's why they closed off our window over there.
Yeah.
And we've been bombed and everything. Ku Klux Klan even tried to bomb this place.
I wish I'd known that before I showed up.
Yeah, well.
I'm scared now to leave.
Exactly.
Well, so, we changed the city, you know. Our community did it.
So what's the future of Impact Houston? What do y'all have planned? What are the long range?
You know, again, we're always going to have this core base to us that will be, you know, anytime there's an issue coming out, whether it be on a local level or a national level, we're going to try to bring that to the Houston community. But again, we're really wanting to try to reach out to other organizations, stand up for people who we feel are being treated unjustly, even if it's not because of GLBT issues. If it's race, if it's religion, if it's gender, if it's age, anything like that, we really want to try to start reaching out to those groups and show that we don't want people to say, well, they only care about that because it affects them. And we don't want that. We want them to understand that we really just care that about everyone being treated equal regardless.
Well, yeah, I like how Impact Houston has become a part of the community, and you're visible at other events. Like, I saw you at AIDS Walk, you were in the Pride Parade,
you know, you're visible, and you're not just not doing your one little niche thing. You're doing multiple things.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So I think that's visible and appreciated in the community.
Well, it's important to mobilize the community. That's always been there's always been certain organizations taking care of certain things without our community, but as our community has evolved. And as acceptance of our community has broadened here in Houston and other areas, we lose that focus. And we have to realize that we're all part of the same community now. Too many times we try to isolate ourselves. And
well, you know, I think the kind of the older generation, the 30s and 40s age, were very focused on HIV and AIDS, and that's kind of was the community endeavor and, you know, obstacle.
Well, it pulled the community together because that was part of, you know, we were losing our friends.
Exactly. And now we're seeing this younger generation that see the human rights and, the gay rights as the primary issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's important for us to the battle's not over for
absolutely
protections.
Not. Right. We aren't protected right now. There are no city, there's no state protections for us.
No, as a matter of fact, quite the opposite.
Yeah. As we all well know.
Yes. One of the questions I wanted to ask, I know that what other activities have you done? Some of the historical things. You did the event right after Proposition 8, and then there was another one that I remember that was on West Gray.
Yes, that was in January, I believe, and that was it more in response to DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act.
Okay, and what has there been since then? Anything?
There was a tax, like a protest for taxes.
Yes, on April 15th, actual tax day, they actually organized at the downtown post office, and then there was actually some smaller groups at some of the other post offices around town. Just as people were there doing their last-minute tax filings, just bring it to their attention that those taxes you pay and that I pay as well offer you rights that I don't get.
We are excluded from, exactly.
So.
And again, at Pride. So absolutely. y'all been just about
y'all
everywhere.
Y'all are walking the walk. You're not just out there yakking.
We always try to be there the best we can, and that's why we're just wanting to always continue to grow.
And how do you reach kind of the younger people? I mean, how are y'all reaching this demographic?
I mean, I will say that we definitely try to capitalize off events like Pride because that's just such a great core group of people to try to connect with, but also we try to use what, you know, everyone else uses, like the social networks such as Facebook and MySpace, and we're always trying to keep the internet, the website up and going, because we know that's where people go. It's where I go, you know.
That's where everybody goes.
If I can't click on it, I'm, you know.
If you just joined us, we're talking with James Oxford of Impact Houston, and we're talking about two events coming up, and I'm going to get you to repeat the two events real quickly.
Okay. We have the Sizzling Summer Soiree on August 9th, Sunday at the Love It Inn, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m., which is just kind of a fundraiser.
501 Love It.
501 Love It. Tickets at impact-houston.com. And then also on August 15th at 1 p.m. at Discovery Green will be the Great National Kiss-In. It'll be taking place all across the United States, but Discovery Green will be the Houston location.
Okay.
I want to go to that. That'll be fun.
I think I would, too. So now that I know I don't have to bring my own partner, I can...
Of course,
you know,
not.
You can find another couple and like just kind of have like a three-way kiss.
Keep it spicy.
We have to realize that everything will end up on Facebook, so we have to be careful.
It'll be on the news.
That's one thing about the
crazy trans lady invades kiss.
The phones that take photographs. And especially the ones that take actual videos.
Yes.
Yeah. And it all ends up on Facebook.
On YouTube,
YouTube or Facebook.
Yeah. We're in the digital age, baby. It's out.
So be careful who you're kissing on the 15th or any time for that matter. What's in the future? We've got these coming up, and that only takes us to this month. What's down the line? Anything that you know of?
We don't have any specific events set up at this point in time. We do happy hours every month now. Again, another way just to kind of socialize and get people.
And when are these?
Are these on Facebook?
They're on Facebook, you know, and I feel awful to say this, but I don't know when the one is coming up this month. I want to say it's not this week, but next week, and it's usually on a Thursday.
So it's just Impact Houston on Facebook?
Yeah, Impact Houston on Facebook. Okay. Absolutely. And again,
impact-houston.com. So those of you who aren't on Facebook, you'll know to go get
and if you're not on Facebook, get on Facebook.
And if you're not on Facebook, up with
what
that?
What rock are you
doing? What's up with that if you're not on Facebook? Queer Voices is on Facebook.
Yes, we have over 400 members.
And all of the crew. Well, you and I, anyway, are on Facebook.
Jack is on Facebook.
Oh, and Glenn is, too.
Yes.
No, Glenn's not.
Oh, Glenn
he was giving us the high sign. He wasn't volunteering. He was telling us one more minute and we're golfing.
We're wrapping up.
I thought you were volunteering. Yeah.
Now, James, how did you get involved with Impact?
I was giving you the magic fickle finger of fate.
I got that.
That's not the usual finger you give us.
We were having too much fun over here.
Me and Lance had just moved back from New York in October.
New York.
And while we were there, you felt so much more comfortable as, you know, a homosexual couple. It was just very out and open and everything. So when we came back, we're like, we really need to get involved, you know. There's no reason it can't be like this in Houston. And one of the first events after we got back was the rally downtown. So we got back October 14th, and that was on, like, November
8th.
Yeah. And so we went to that event and met Megan and Lindsay for the first time.
I love Megan and Lindsay.
History from there.
That's right. Absolutely. Right.
Well, join Impact Houston this Saturday.
Sunday.
Oh, sorry. Sunday. I had Saturday on my mind. Sunday at the Lovett Inn.
That's 501 Lovett.
501 Lovett. Sunday, 2 to 5.
That's their fundraiser, so plan on coming and enjoying
you
yourself.
Have to buy a
Be
ticket.
Casual.
You have to buy a ticket, but I'm sure they're very reasonable and they're available.
You can buy tickets at the door.
You can. We're really hoping people try to buy as many up front as possible just so we have a good feel for how many are coming.
Exactly.
If you can, buy ahead of time, but let them know that you're coming so that they'll be prepared for you.
Yep.
And come and join. And then the following week on
August 15th.
Kiss.
It will be the Get Great Kiss In. So yes. At Discovery Green at 1 p.m.
No, James, are you going to be kissing Lance?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I'll bring my camera.
That's our arrangement.
I'll bring my camera for Facebook.
All right.
And we've been talking with James Oxford, the publicity director of Impact Houston.
Thank you.
This
is Queer Voices.
We have tragic late-breaking news. A weekly support group for queer youth was being held in the basement of the local LGBT center in downtown Tel Aviv, Israel, on the night of August 1st, when a masked man dressed in black walked in and randomly sprayed the room with machine gun fire. At least two were killed, a young adult counselor and a 16 or 17-year-old girl, and more than a dozen, some in serious condition, were rushed to area hospitals. The unknown gunman fled on foot, and in this still-developing story, police are conducting a door-to-door manhunt for him. There's only speculation about his motive at this point, but local activists said inflammatory anti-gay rhetoric by ultra-Orthodox Jewish leaders could have spurred the assault. Tel Aviv has long been considered the most queer-friendly city in Israel, so news of the shooting has literally shocked the nation. Condemnations have ranged from local Tel Aviv officials and religious leaders to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Hundreds of LGBT people and their friends held a vigil and protest against homophobia less than a block from the crime scene on August 2nd, and more demonstrations are planned in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities. We'll have much more about all this next time on This Way Out. We've got a transatlantic conversation with an opinionated pansy later in the program. Political pressure again shot down another attempt to at least temporarily suspend U.S. military discharges under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow spoke with the frustrated congressman this week.
Congressman Elsie Hastings of Florida introduced an amendment this week to the Defense Appropriations Act that would have prevented the government from spending money on kicking gays out of the military. And then the next day, he withdrew that amendment, releasing a statement explaining that he withdrew it, quote, due to pressure from some of my congressional colleagues and from the White House. Joining us now is the man who was thwarted yesterday in his attempt to cut off funding for the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Congressman Hastings, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rachel. I like that word, thwarted, because that's exactly what I was.
Well, tell me how that happened. What sort of pressure did you receive from the White House? How did it all go down?
Well, certainly I didn't speak with President Obama. Let me get that very clear. But how the process works is there are liaisons that work here at the Capitol that come from the White House. And before the Rules Committee meets, there is a meeting. In this particular instance, there were persons from the White House that were there, and when the discussion was had with reference to my amendment, they chimed in. And their thinking, Rachel, is different than I believe yours and mine would be. I have a different political calculus. If something is bigoted, and if your intent is to see to it that it does not continue, then I did not understand the leadership of Congress or the White House saying that the time is not right. My position is the president has said that he wishes that this matter be repealed. My colleague Patrick Murphy now has more than 170 co-sponsors on a measure to repeal it. Secretary Gates has said, I'm glad he is now saying when we change our policy. Last year he would have been saying if, but my view is that the time is now to eliminate this bigoted law once and for all.
When you are hearing that the time isn't right, are you also hearing that there is a White House-endorsed strategy for when to get rid of it, or is it just being put off indefinitely?
Very good question. I have not heard anything other than the rhetoric. I wrote to the White House on June 22nd and had 76 other members of Congress to join me in a letter to the president explaining what the president can do right now. And that's what I was attempting to do with the amendment. And that's say to the Secretary of Defense, stop it. Just don't put anybody else out of service. The soldiers that we are forcibly separating are combat veterans. They're intelligence officers. They speak the languages that we need on the battlefield. So aside from the absurdity of telling dedicated soldiers that we don't want them because they're gay, this law negatively impacts our national security. And let me just go one step further and say in the last 5 years, we've put out of the service under this policy 59 Arabic speakers and 9 Farsi linguists. I serve on the Select Committee on Intelligence. And I'm telling you, we cannot afford at all not to have language speakers with the paucity of language speakers we have in the intelligence community.
Congressman Hastings, as you know, the Beltway common wisdom on this is that this is an incredibly sensitive issue, that a lot of political capital yeah. needs to be invested in this, that President Clinton was immeasurably hurt by the way that he pursued this issue at the start of his first term. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that that's true now, that this would be an incredibly risky issue for the president to take a leadership role on?
I really do not. The majority of Americans do not support Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Without question, every poll has shown an uptick in favor of us getting rid of this policy. And the one that is particularly salient is that members of the military are in favor of getting rid of this policy. It is shameful for us to continue to wait with reference to this matter. I keep hearing that we'll do it next year. Well, in my view, that's ridiculous. If you know we want to do it, let's do it today and spare any more of our servicemen and women from the humiliation of being investigated for their sexual orientation.
Democratic Congressman Alcee Hastings of Florida spoke this week with Rachel Maddow on her MSNBC cable news program. In a further indictment of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a recent study released by New York's prestigious Cornell University suggests that the ban on openly lesbian and gay personnel in the U.S. military may be lowering performance, in some cases to life-threatening levels. The study found that gay and lesbian respondents who were told to conceal their sexual orientation performed 20% worse on spatial reasoning tests and 50% worse on physical endurance tests than gay and lesbian subjects who were not given that order. The authors say this is the first research to find a link between the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and relevant military tasks. Things are certainly different with a major U.S. ally, openly gay Iraq combat veteran and member of the Windsor-based Household Cavalry Regiment, Trooper James Wharton, graced the cover of the July 2009 issue of the British Army's Soldier magazine, along with a large single-word banner, Pride. Officials said the publication was celebrating diversity in the armed forces. The UK dropped its ban on openly lesbian gay service members almost a decade ago. Several other US allies have done the same. Wharton, who is soon to be promoted to Lance Corporal, told the magazine that he received an overwhelmingly positive response when he came out after basic training. He said that he couldn't understand the logic of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Meanwhile, U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Carl Levin of Michigan has agreed to hold hearings on the policy this fall, according to a statement issued this week by Democratic New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Gillibrand also previously failed to get a proposed moratorium on Don't Ask, Don't Tell past the political barricades. San Francisco's legendary queer band Pansy Division celebrates 20 years of rock with a new CD, Not So Gay, a DVD, and a memoir by lead singer John Ginoli. The band is also playing a series of live shows across the USA. This way out, Brisbane, Australia correspondent John Frame, a devoted fan, spoke by phone with the group's co-founder, co-writer, bassist, and vocalist Chris Freeman in Los Angeles.
Chris Freeman, I've had the pleasure of chatting with you over the last 15 years, but Pansy Division have been together now for nearly 20 years, which is a great landmark.
Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable, actually, because we didn't put a shelf life on ourselves, but, I mean, if you would have asked me in the beginning, you know, especially the first 3 years, I would never have considered that we would still be together at this point, so I'm very shocked and delighted also.
Lovely. Another landmark is it's just gone 40th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. Have you seen personally then a big change in that 20 years until Pansy Division and 20 years until now?
I've definitely seen a change. The cultural zeitgeist has changed. Even like Nick and Nora's playlist, you see, you know, he's in a queer core band, and there's all these now touchstones, and I think people are more cognizant and okay with people. I mean, Adam Lambert on American Idol, I think, is a great example. I think, especially in kids, I mean, that's where I measure success, is with kids. And I think kids are a lot more okay with gay issues. But by the same token, you've got people using phrases like, that's so gay, or now there's a new one I just heard about called No Homo. I guess these it's sort of in the hip-hop community, they kind of use that as like saying, yeah, I'm not BSing you, you know, they'll say no homo. And just things like that, where people are just using these, using gay people as sort of a scapegoat in just modern vernacular, that's showing you that, you know, this is still an issue that's going to have to keep being pecked away at bit by bit, so.
Because yeah. It's not necessarily true when you're dealing with issues of oppression for sexuality that any publicity is better than no publicity. But movies like Bruno are going to have good and bad effects on homophobia.
I read a review, I guess the SF Chronicle online did a review saying it's pretty much not a funny film, and that it seems like it's using gay people and actually for the wrong reasons because it's not funny. The argument I had with somebody on the phone today about it was that he was making sweeping statements about how the film was portraying gay people and how it was, you know, perpetuating stereotypes and it's sending the wrong message out there. And I said, but it's a comedy. It's supposed to be doing all of that. But if it's true, if it's not a funny film, and my point to my friend was, well, don't make a judgment until you've seen it, and then that way you can judge, you know, accurately. But you know, people who have seen it are not coming back with favorable results, so maybe it is going to end up looking badly on the gay community. But I think, you know, comedy is meant to be satirical. So, you know, if it's pointing out stereotypes, I mean, basically we'd have the same accusations leveled with us. You know, you're perpetuating gay stereotypes, you know, by talking about having sex all the time. I have a song that I wrote called I'm Gonna Be a Slut, which is sort of a, you know, right now, especially in the light of all the marriage issues that we're trying to fight here, sort of flies in the face of that. We've been accused of that same thing. And, you know, all I'm saying is, you know, I think open your mind and let things roll out and see what happens. Honestly, there's not much that's gonna help the gay community until we can stop the people who point, you know, to the sky and say, whatever it is up in the sky told us that this is wrong and that this kind of behavior in human beings is unnatural and we're going to punish you for it, then we've got a huge battle. Until that one's won, we've got a huge battle.
Yep. Brokeback Mountain did a great deal of good in the world by presenting that it's about love, it's not just about sex. And Pansy Division have written plenty of songs that are about the fact that it's not just sex, it's love that matters.
That's right. Well, it was important at first to be shocking, I think. So I think that people who know us from our first maybe one album or two albums are going to think that's all we've been about. And it's only until we hit like our sixth album, Absurd Pop Song Romance, where we actually tilted the scales more towards the love side of it and the good and bad sides of that, and actually dealing with relationships and stuff. So, but by that point, maybe what people had as an opinion of us had already been shaped, and they weren't willing to keep going with, you know, paying attention to us. But for us, it was very important to say, okay, now that we've got your attention, we have some other things we'd like to say. You know, we actually have songs that are non-gender specific, like You're Gonna Need Your Friends, you know, Sweet Insecurity. Those are songs that actually a straight band could do, and it would hold water. So, but I think, especially you bring up Brokeback Mountain, I think that's a very important cultural benchmark. And my feeling about it when I saw it was, darn, they didn't win, you know, because I would have liked to have seen something, you know, positive that people were getting into, but maybe just the fact that it was a tragedy helped people to swallow the fact that, you know, that it was a gay film, you know, because they didn't end up together. So in some people's moral judgment, they might have thought, yeah, those two men should never have ended up together. Well, maybe that's what made it popular, but by the same token, you know, I'd like to see a positive gay movie get the accolades that one did.
Yeah. There's the new album, That's So Gay, also the DVD, Pansy Division Life in a Gay Rock Band, and John's book, his memoirs, Deflowered, My Life in Pansy Division. The world is your oyster at the moment.
I also wanted to say one of the things we never take for granted is that with all the stimulus that people have out there in the world, to be able to get anybody's attention is always a thrill and an honor. And so if anyone's out there that's been paying attention and listening in, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
This has been John Frame in Brisbane, speaking with Chris Freeman from Pansy Division in Los Angeles for This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Christopher David Trentum, Chris Coleman, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, and John Frame contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle. Pansy Division performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KGNU, Boulder, Fort Collins, Ward, and Denver, Colorado, 3BBD, Ballarat, Victoria, WYEP, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. For the 1,114th time, stay tuned.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles.
Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
90.1 FM at Howl in the Blues proudly present A Howl in the Heights. Hey, this is the Blues Hound inviting you to join us on Sunday, September 27th at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, located at 1031 East 24th Street in the Heights. This is going to be a special show benefiting your listener-sponsored community radio, 90.1 FM. $10 is going to get you in the door to hear the music of the Space City Aces and the Brad Absher Band. Once again, that's A Howl in the Heights, Sunday, September 27th from 4 to 7. Doors open at 3. Come on, get off the porch and run with the big dogs. Ow! KPFT Houston.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for peace.
When it goes on the attack, the swine flu virus can't distinguish between a person who has health insurance and a person who is uninsured. So perhaps it's germane to talk about a national health care plan. Yes, we need to wash our hands to help keep the swine flu virus at bay. But longer term, we also need to cover all of the people in this country with affordable health care. What, you may ask, is so likable about a national health care plan? It saves taxpayers money. Everybody's in, nobody's out. You go to the doctor of your choice. You get the treatment you need, and at a price you, Joe and Jane taxpayer, can afford.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.